be in England in the summertime. And we are in England in the summertime. I'm Andrew Harrison, playing us in there. It was a big mouth first, the inimitable sounds of the doyen of string and piano arrangements for Pop and Dudley, of ZTT, ABC, Malcolm McLaren, Electronic Pulp, and many more fame. She's here with us today, and we're all wearing comedy tragedy masks, and we're represented on the show today by Spanners and Burnt Out Cars in the Art of Noise style. That was Anne's piano arrangements of Close to the Edit by The Art of Noise from her new album, And Dudley Plays the Art of Noise, in which she rearranges the classics of pipe banging and VW engines for pianoforte. Hello, Anne. Welcome to Big Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
How are you doing?
I'm very well indeed in the summertime.
Excellent. We're going to talk about your life in pop a little bit later, but first, why arrange The Art of Noise for piano? It seems to be right against the raison d'etre of The Art of Noise.
Well, it was to make a point, really. Mm-hmm. Some years ago, there was some compilation released of some Art of Noise tracks. And I did an interview, and I was explaining to the interviewer how we use the technology and we use the computers, you know, in this sort of very free-form way and as part of the whole sort of way that we improvised. And he came back to me and he said, oh, no, it's not really music at all, is it? Because it was just written by computers. And this sort of preyed upon my mind a bit. And I thought, is this what people think? Because to me, The Art of Noise, as well as all the bangs and crashes, had all these sort of clever chord sequences and nice melodies and sort of witty parts. And I thought, well, I know what I'll do. I'll prove him wrong, OK? Yes. I'll do it on the piano. I'll show where the melodies came from and I'll take it right back to the basics. And then there was a load of other people sort of started releasing piano albums, like Rick Wakeman and Benny Anderson. And I thought, oh, now's the time. Mm. But, of course, being me, I didn't want to do it entirely straight, just piano, because I thought that would be a bit soporific. So I decided to look at using the piano in a way to do all the sounds. So if I wanted to have a sort of conga or bongo pattern, I would sort of play this pattern on the lid.
Oh.
And if I wanted to have a bang or a crash for the drum, I would sort of bang the inside of the piano.
So it's live handmade sampling. You're a human Fairlight.
Yes, indeed. So I did do a degree of programming using sounds that I derived from the piano. So everything that you hear is actually derived from a piano.
I thought it might be different sounds, but it's actually from a piano. That's amazing.
And very, very highly processed sometimes. Yeah, yeah, you know, we use the studio still as a very creative tool.
Yeah. So what I always liked about The Art of Noise was that the bangs and the crashes and the noises and the strange sonic events actually were musical. They were musically integrated. And when you hear Close to the Edit, you realise that that's kind of rolling blues bass line.
Yeah, exactly.
They are songs.
Exactly.
It wasn't just a load of clatter.
Well, exactly. And that's what sort of bugged me about this perception, perhaps, that we were just sort of tapping away on computer keyboards. Nothing could have been further from the truth.
Yeah. It's a very poignant sounding record as well. Pianos make things poignant, don't they? The version of Video Killed the Radio Star.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a bit of a weeper.
Well, I always thought Video Killed the Radio Star is a very, very sad song. It's about how technology makes you obsolete. Mm. And I think we all sort of feel, as you get older and you see your kids and young people can sort of grasp technology so much quicker than you can, and you think, yeah, that's me. It's happening.
Well, we're holding out that Video Won't Kill the Podcast Star. We're going to hear more about The Art of Noise and Anne's illustrious pop history later, but there are some other people here too. You just heard her. As usual, we have Sian Pattenden, the £30,000 Fairlight sampler to my £2 Casio VL tone. Hello, Sian, how are you?
Nothing wrong with a Casio VL tone.
Well,
no.
You can carry it in your pocket.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
You can't get out the Fairlight.
Yeah.
Do you think we should have more piano arrangements for pianoforte of pop?
Oh, I think we should have early music, Daphne and Celeste, actually.
Oh, what, played on the Krumholm?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, it is the modern folk music, isn't it? Kanye West for piano, Cocktail Stormzy.
All of that, absolutely. Let's pare it down.
Pare it down. We have another special guest today. Would you like to introduce her?
I would indeed. Sophie Harris writes for Mojo, The Guardian, Men's Health and Rolling Stone, among many others. She also broadcasts on the BBC World Service and WNYC Radio in New York. Hence the name. In her spare time, she teaches yoga. Please, can you teach me? And has a folk rock band called Springfield.
Springfield.
When she can fit that all in. And she's here with us today. Hello, Sophie. How are you?
Hello, I'm fine, thanks. What a lovely intro. I'm also pleased to hear it because you guys are obviously two women I've respected so massively over the years and have been inspired by. So it's nice to have that little reminder of like, oh, you've done some stuff too.
Yeah, but my rejoinder is But yes, you're bendy.
It's true.
I can't get there. Yeah. What exciting stuff have you been up to recently?
What have I been up to recently? Well, I'm actually about to move house, so I feel like that's been taking over my world completely. So listening to old records, putting things in boxes.
Have you found lots of old records that previously sort of stuffed behind things?
Yeah, quite a few. Nice little record of Hawaiian chants from the 70s. A lot of old charity shop records and good stuff like that. Jake Thackeray record, that's been out lately.
Mm-hmm. And do you combine these with yoga practice ever? Because that's a class I'd go to.
Not so much those ones, but I do get very obsessive with my yoga playlists. And also the poignant piano. It's like the tipping point between your sort of massage piano and poignant, I'm crying now in goddess pose. You know, so it's got to be very carefully done. Yes. But yeah, love a bit of piano music.
Perhaps you and Anne can create the perfect orchestral folk piano yoga music.
Down dog, here we come.
And then can we have a theory class afterwards when our brains
are the music theory. Yeah.
Sparkly.
Fantastic. Later in the show, we'll be looking at Millie Jackson Exposed, a brand new restoration of her 1970s raunchy rock period, remade and spruced up by Steve Levine, producer of those Culture Club records. And it's summer. Yay! So our guest will be telling us what you could be listening to and reading while spatchcocked on that Polynesian beach or dodging those pesky tourismo donkeys in Blackpool, wherever you go on your holidays. But first, a completely important message from Andrew.
If Big Mouth is a fun part of your week, then why not support us and help us pay our studio bills by pledging us a few quid via the crowdfunding platform Patreon? A small contribution from everyone will help keep the show in rude health. All we're asking for is the equivalent of a pint of beer at today's slightly unnerving prices, a mere £5 a month, to cover our studio costs. We don't even want a gin and tonic out of you. We're halfway to our target of £600 a month, and once we hit it, we're going to start recording extra bits each week for our Patreon backers. So go to patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast to find out more, and the link is at the top of the Big Mouth Facebook page as well. All we are saying is, buy us a pint. Okay, our special guest today is Anne Dudley, as you were just hearing, string arranger to the pop elite, pianist, conductor, film score composer and member of the Art of Noise. Among the records she's worked on were ABC's classic Lexicon of Love and Lexicon of Love 2 as well, the follow-up. Malcolm McLaren's Duck Rock, which invented world music. George Michael's Careless Whisper and Pulp's Different Class and This Is Hardcore albums. We're going to ask her about her life in pop after a couple of Dudley classics. ABC's Look of Love Part 4, the orchestra on, and Malcolm McLaren's Double Dutch with the string sounds of Anne Dudley. You should do an album called The String Sounds of Anne Dudley in Woolies in the 70s. Anne, I interviewed Trevor once and he called you Bo Dudley. He said you're the go-to person for strings. How did you end up doing this? Was Dollar where you started out?
No, I started out... I met Trevor when I was depping in a band because... This is going back a bit. I was playing keyboards and he came along and played bass. And we obviously were sort of on the same wavelength because we didn't actually want to be playing in these bands forever. These were bands that did cover versions in discos. I don't know if you remember.
Great
way
times.
Back the disco, you know, sounds like it comes from another era. And Trevor started producing records and he was looking for a keyboard player. And he liked the sound of my Wurlitzer electric piano, which I had, you know, I'd sort of got a mortgage out on Wurlitzer electric piano. And in fact, he said to me, "Do you hire out your piano?" And I said, "No, if you have my piano, you've got to have me." So he had to hire me as well.
It's just early Trevor Horn attitude to musicians. I don't want the musicians.
Yeah, exactly. So then, you know, we started working together and Trevor went on to bigger and better things. And yes, indeed, I think one of the first records we ever did to, together was Dollar, Give Me Back My Heart, mm-hmm. and Videotech. Mm-hmm. This is probably about 1982. Mm-hmm. And then ABC came along.
Yes.
And they also didn't have a keyboard player. And so they wanted Trevor to produce their album, Lexicon of Love. And they were very ambitious, had big ideas and wanted a big sound. And so Trevor said to me, would you like to do a string arrangement? And I said, oh, yeah, yeah, fine.
What, a string arrangement?
No idea. No idea. So I went home and I listened to all my favourite records, like, you know, Papa Was a Rolling Stone and all that, Millie Jackson, and thought, listened to those string lines and things and thought, oh, I see, that's what you do. Yeah, I could do that, yeah. So, you know, at that age, in your early 20s, you say yes to everything, don't you?
And was that the look of love?
Yeah.
So you, that was your first arrangement?
More or less. So I found myself conducting these sort of hardened session musicians in Abbey Road, you know, at the tender age of, you know, early 20s. And I was the youngest person in the room. And, you know, I'm still here. And sometimes I look around at a session, I think, I'm the oldest person in the room now. But hey-ho, things change.
It must have been absolutely nerve-wracking then, trying to get these guys and women who've been...
Well, you just sort of play the role of an actor, don't you? You think, OK, I'm the sort of person who can do this, even though inside, you know, you're shitting yourself. Oh, no.
You can't say that.
Inside,
it's a podcast.
OK, inside you think, oh, God, you know, you're sort of falling apart. But you think, OK, I've got to appear to be really confident and really in charge of this. So you do.
So the insane success of Lexicon of Love and that huge sound that we hadn't really heard before, that hadn't been a kind of a mega opulent Vegas Sinatra pop album ever, really. That was kind of the beginning of the whole, you know, your thing with Trevor that led into ZTT, that led into all the other stuff, wasn't it? It was the door kind of opening to that megapop.
It's interesting you should say that. I mean, to me, it was just a sort of continuation of the music that I loved, you know, that I loved listening to growing up, Motown, The Sound of Philadelphia, what George Martin did with the Beatles. You know, to me, it was all in that sort of tradition. So it wasn't... It's interesting. People thought it was breaking new ground, but it wasn't to me. It's interesting how people's perceptions are.
It's probably like ignorant young people like me who have never heard Henry Mancini or never heard Nelson Riddle go, this is amazing. And your granddad then goes, have you heard this?
Yeah.
And you
well,
go,
it's,
oh, right.
It's still
but
the same.
It's the juxtaposition, though, isn't it? It's the Philly with the synth. That was the kind of mind blower, wasn't it?
I guess so, yeah. Yeah, looking back on it, I mean, it still sounds really good.
Yeah.
And
it does.
We've been out touring it. We do a live show with ABC and the South Bank Sinfonia. And it's such fun to play those arrangements live. And the South Bank Sinfonia are all very young people. They're usually under 30, and they never heard it the first time round. And they really enjoy it, and they get into it, and it's fantastic.
So also working on Lexicon was, I believe, wasn't Gary Langan and J.J. Yetzirlik were also there? So this is kind of where the Art of Noise forms.
Exactly, yes.
How did the Art of Noise happen? Is this you messing around before the band has turned up?
Well, yeah, more or less like that, yeah. And because J.J. used to sort of take control of the technology part of it, this sort of sampling synthesizer that we had called the Fairlight. And Gary was an amazing engineer who just sort of used all that technology in a very innovative way. And he's just always trying to get new sounds out of things. And, you know, the two of them would sort of mess about with drum sounds that they'd recorded and loop them round and do all sorts of things with them. And then I'd come in and sort of put some tunes over the top. And we became like the sort of house band, I suppose.
Yeah. Like the Wrecking Crew, Muscle Shoals of banging electronics.
Yeah, exactly.
So were you charged with providing the structure?
Well, the structure's always interesting.
Or you can be as creative as the people messing around.
Well, I think I was as creative as the people messing around. I always say that I always thought that we were sort of breaking new ground and doing sort of semi-classical Stockhausen-y sort of things, experimental things. And then I'd come back the next morning and found that overnight they put the hip hop beats on it. You know? But the combination of the two was recognised, but we were very lucky because we were on Island Records, and Chris Blackwell, who's a great sort of entrepreneur and great sort of hero of 70s and 80s music, recognised that this was really quite commercial because we had no idea. And it was him, really, who was very interested in getting the stuff that we were doing out and released.
So if you're a fair bit younger than me, were you aware of Art of Noise on that? Because to me, this was the weirdest music I'd ever seen. There was no band. There was this music sounded, as Andrew said, it sounded like what I now know Stockhausen is. It's bolted together. The first record was, you know, the Andrews sisters jammed together with, I think, the drummer from Yes, wasn't it? Was it Alan White from Yes?
I couldn't possibly comment.
Couldn't possibly comment. Have you never heard anything like it in your life? Did it make an impression on you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because I think it's, you know, for all the sort of art and complexity of it, it's so kind of saturated and crisp and immediate, and when especially when you're little and you're watching Top of the Pops, that's the sort of like what you know, so it's definitely one of those moments for me,
yeah,
for sure.
And your records came out plastered with all of Paul Morley's immensely pretentious and fabulously, ridiculously over-the-top philosophy.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
God, I'd love to read that.
Oh, it's brilliant. Oh, I pinched a load of it for my English A-level essay. I got very high marks. No, you've been reading very widely, Andrew. No, just been reading the back of Arthur Moore's record.
He would put not so much sleeve notes as manifestos on the back, raiding the 20th century. And in fact, it was he who came up with the name Art of Noise. And we thought, gosh, that's such a good name. We've got to be good now, because it doesn't sound like a group. It sounds like a whole movement.
Mm.
You know, we thought, oh, that sounds really quite important. Oh, Art of Noise, like that. So I mean, that all credit to Paul. And he came up with a lot of the titles.
Yeah.
And the sort of humorous pretension of it was all part of it, really.
Yeah. And yet one of the, probably the pinnacle of Art of Noise is an immensely simple tune, Moments in Love, which is really beautifully pared down. Famously, Madonna got married to it, didn't she?
She did.
How did that come about? What is it?
Well, I think one of the other things that was influencing us was the minimalism of Steve Reich and those American composers, and the idea that something would go over and over and over and loop round. I mean, this is probably, we were a little bit ahead of our time, I suppose, because a lot of later rave stuff used to do that ad infinitum. So it was the idea of having something looping around for a very, very long time with gradual changes to it, gradual developments.
And yet very listenable. Steve Reich in the Afternoon. It's very, very good on the ears.
That's very good.
Yeah. You can have that. I've been sitting on that one for years. Tell us, the ZTT and Trevor Gary house band also made Malcolm McLaren's Duck Rock.
Yeah.
Tell us about that, because that was kind of the, before that, you know, what we now call world music was not really considered to be part of the pop canon at all.
Yeah, well, Malcolm McLaren was a great innovator and a very restless mind, you know, and he had so many ideas. And one of the things that he would do is he'd travel around the world and he'd listen to the music that he heard. And we're talking the 80s now, and it wasn't so easy to just sort of go on Spotify and find anything you like from any culture at any time. So he'd been to South Africa and he'd heard these South African beats, which he loved. And he'd been to America and he'd been up in the mountains, the Appalachian Mountains. And he'd sort of sampled some of these guys doing the traditional songs like Buffalo Girls. And then he got Trevor involved and he said, I want to combine this with this. And I've got these rappers from America and I want... And they literally went to several interesting places in the world, including Soweto and the Appalachian Mountains and New York, to get the world famous Supreme Team. And they brought all this material back to Britain, and we sort of sorted through it, sifted through it, and made these tracks.
So you didn't get carted around the world yourself?
No, I never went anywhere.
Oh, no.
You might have thought you'd get the travel benefits.
No, I ended up in Whitechapel, in a basement studio.
Now, you told me once that that Psalm East in Whitechapel was quite a... For this opulent, beautiful megapop, it was quite a dingy little dive.
Yeah, it was at the bottom of Brick Lane, and it was beneath a sort of clothing shop. And it was a bit dodgy at night, walking back to Aldgate East Tube. Yeah, and it was the last place you'd expect to find this studio out of which a lot of innovative stuff was being produced.
But also luxurious and beautiful and gleaming and towering stuff. That's often how it's made, isn't it, in rubbishy little spaces, tiny spaces.
Yeah.
So eventually kind of Art of Noise split with ZTT and had a more kind of conventional pop life, and this was sort of the beginning of you as the string arranger to the Glitterati. So we're going to have a couple more tunes and then talk about that. This is Getting Away With It by Electronic, and then The Theatre by the Pet Shop Boys from their album Day.
I've been forcing myself not to forget just to feel words. I've been getting away with it all.
That was Electronic with Getting Away With It, and the Pet Shop Boys with The Theatre from their 1993 album Very Strings, of course, by Anne Dudley. Anne, you've done everybody from Paul McCartney to S Club 7. What are people looking for when they ask for an Anne Dudley string arrangement? What are you the go-to person, do you think, for?
Well, what does a string arrangement do to a song? What should a string arrangement do to a song? I guess a string arrangement should make it better in some way, to make the chorus soar a bit more, to be more involving, to involve a bit more emotion. I mean, look at the benefits of having a string orchestra. You've got another sort of 30-40 musicians giving their energy to a record. So it should sort of polish it off, to finish it off, you know, and that's what I aim to do. I never like those string arrangements which shout, "I'm really clever," you know, yes, and sort of don't seem to fit the tune somehow. I sometimes do things which are extremely simple, because if that's what's required, that's what I want to do.
Yeah, like All of My Heart by ABC, for instance.
All of My Heart is not particularly elaborate. Mm. Getting Away With It was quite interesting, because that was quite a difficult one to
was
do.
It?
Yeah, because the bass line doesn't quite fit the chords, and then the tune doesn't quite fit the chords and the bass line. So I thought, well, what do I do with the strings? I can't sort of lay down the chords, really. So what I wanted to do with the strings is to sort of make them float over the top.
They glide, yeah.
In a sort of English pastoral way. Mm. And I remember when we did it in the studio, it was one of those horrific days where I'd actually been slightly late. I mean, in my life, I've only been late twice for a session.
She was very punctual
today.
This
was one of those times. And so I was a bit sort of stressed. But we only had this one track to do, so it should have been all right. And then we did the first run through, and I went in and listened to it, and I thought, well, that doesn't sound very good. And the engineer said, oh, I know what to do. And he went out and he moved all the microphones further away from the strings, whereby introducing all this beautiful air into the
That's
arrangement.
Really good.
And it suddenly started to sound quite Vaughan Williams-y, quite classical. And Neil was there and he said, that sounds fantastic. And it worked.
Mm.
But, there was a slightly dodgy moment.
I love that it was something so simple, though, that was the answer. You know what I mean?
And it was all credit to the engineer, John Timperley, actually, who was a great engineer and sadly passed away not long ago. And he used to work at Angel Studios, which is still a great studio I work at all the time. And how wonderful that he sort of was thinking outside the box. You know, what can I do? How can I make this happen? You know, it wasn't just sort of doing his job. It's like, oh, I could get creative as well. So that was great.
Tell us about Macca, because you worked on Paul McCartney's Press to Play, and Give My Regards to Broad Street, the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Is it possible to tell a Beatle you should do this?
No, you don't do
you
that.
You can't tell a Beatle
don't
what to do.
You don't do that. Though I did play keyboards on that track. It'll come to me. Anyway, and there was a chord at the end that I had the pleasure of showing Paul McCartney how to voice it, because he was playing piano and I was playing synthesizer. And I said, well, we could go to this chord at the end. And he said, I don't know what that is. So I said, well, look, it's this. So there you go.
Told a Beatle.
Well, I didn't tell him. I just sort of...
She supported him.
She helped the Beatle. What was he like to...
Oh, he's delightful. I mean, he's one of those people who... He's just so musical. Music is his life. He just wants to do music, you know, and he likes to work with new people and... You know, he's just very easygoing. He loves being in the studio, loves being creative.
But he was also the kind of avant-garde, the secret avant-gardist, wasn't he?
Yeah. I mean, even when I was thinking about summer music for this podcast and I was listening to Dear Prudence, because I feel like that's one of the sort of ultimate summer songs, and just the bass line, it sounds so simple, the bass line, but it's like it's sort of leaping about all over the place and it's like gloriously imperfect as well, you know, and kind of imprecise and super imaginative. And I was thinking exactly that. Like,
yeah. He was all into his music concrete as well, wasn't he?
He was.
Did he know about the Art of Noise? Did he?
Yes, because I worked with him, I think. Yes, he did. Sounds actually. Right. In fact, we did a remix of Spies Like Us, which was a track that he wrote for a film.
Oh.
And Linda came to the session and she was charming and lovely and really easygoing. It was great, actually.
There's the apocryphal story that Yesterday was originally going to be performed by Paul and Delia Derbyshire of the Radiophonic Workshop.
Get out of town.
No, he wanted it to be like that. And then they decided they were going to do it normal. But you know, imagine that Yesterday with a load of Doctor Who noises on it.
Really good. Someone needs to do that. That needs to be like some kind of
barbican. Well, we've got Sorry in the studio and Dudley, you've got your orders.
The cogs
what I was going to ask, if someone asks you to work on a record and you suddenly think, I've got no ideas, what do you go back to listen to get inspiration from?
Probably those great tracks that Gamble and Huff did in the 70s, you know, The Sound of Philadelphia, Teddy Pendergrass, If You Don't Know Me By Now. Those string lines are so gorgeous and so right. And the whole thing fits together so beautifully. But really nowadays, if I listen to something and I think, I don't know that this even needs a string arrangement or wants a string arrangement, I'd actually say... No, I don't think.
While we're talking about Gamble and Huff, you worked on Curler's Whisper.
Yeah.
Which I didn't know about that.
Well, I played keyboards on it.
Ah.
Because I worked with George. I worked with Wham. I did Young Guns.
Oh.
The brass
arrangements. I didn't know that either.
And a couple of things.
Great record. Young.
Sophie's mouth is abdurous. She's like, what?
How was that experience? What was it like working
with
them? Well,
George Michael at the time, he was ever so young. He was about 18. But he was extraordinarily driven and ambitious, and he had the most amazing ear of an untrained musician that I never came across, because I was doing this brass arrangement and we'd done something in one key and then I changed it to another key and I had to slightly change the voicing of the brass, and he said, oh, well, that sounds different there. And I said, well, yeah, because I've had to change the middle bits. And he said, well, can't you do it the same as you did it the first time, you know? And it was, you know, quite an extraordinary perceptive ear that he had.
I heard a story, I can't remember where it was from, but it was that somebody had found themselves at a house party with George Michael in the early 80s when Wham were on top, and the place was full of people dancing and going, oh my God, it's George. Wham come on the stereo and George goes over to the stereo to fix the EQ so that it sounds right in the party.
Yeah,
that's attention to detail.
Yeah, he would have done that,
Which, you're saying that was the horn arrangements on Young Guns that you're talking about.
Yeah, I also
there.
Played keyboards on. There's a 12-inch version of Everything She Wants.
Yeah.
Which sort of does a thing in the middle. And I had this lovely keyboard at the time called a PPG Wave. And it has some great sounds in it, including a sort of vibe sound that I used a lot on the ABC album, and a great brass sound. And it's all over Everything She Wants.
Yeah.
This is what check it out.
One thing I love about the music of that era is that sort of in the 60s and 70s you'd recognise a musician on different you'd recognise a style of playing, but on 80s music it's the actual physical sound, that vibe sound, which you mentioned it there, I totally recognise that and remember it from ABC, and all the kind of, just the grain and the feeling of those particular keys.
Another group that used to use the PPG way was Depeche Mode, so if you listen to some of their tracks you'll think, yes, that sounds a bit like Art of Noise, sounds a bit like Malcolm McLaren.
And you can get all those YouTube videos now where you look up like whatever that famous synth was and someone's like playing all of that. What's the one that was like Take My Breath Away, and it's got Berlin and then it was this and it was that.
Oh, is it a Mellotron where they actually sampled?
It wasn't a Mellotron. It was that iconic, I can't remember the name of it. My boyfriend's a composer. He's going to kill me for forgetting.
Oh, there's so many.
But you have like one little dude in a room, you know, playing them all.
One more question. Orchestra hit. At what point did the orchestra hit get completely overused? Jing, jing. Pet Shop Boys orchestra hits are everywhere. How do you feel about the orchestra hit?
Well, I don't know, because the jury's out, but okay. I think it's my sample. I'm not sure.
All right.
I don't think there's enough orchestra stabs on things these days. Most records can be improved by an orchestra stab. Look at Yes, Owner of a Lonely Heart. Suddenly, it's amazing. Yeah. Before that, it's kind of boring. We could talk about this all day long, and perhaps we should. But I wanted to ask you, what's your favourite arrangement that you created?
I have been asked this before, and I think, all things considered, I think Getting Away With It actually is very good, because I think it adds something special to the song. And I have this memory of my friend John Timperley, and it means a lot to me, and I'm quite proud of it.
Thank God we played it then. We chose the right
good
one.
Choice.
Yeah. And Art of Noise are kind of back on and off. You're still part of Trevor's world.
Yes.
And
yes.
You're still touring with ABC.
Yes.
Which, so we can hear the actual handmade live strings.
Yes.
The string sounds of Anne Dudley. We have to move on to Millie Jackson, infamous for her frank and lascivious between song chat and for being pictured on the toilet on the cover of her 1980 album, Back in the Shit. Georgia-born Millie Jackson is a veteran of R&B, soul, funk and disco, but it's possible that her sexual upfrontness and self-mockery have overshadowed a great soul voice. That could well change with the release of Millie Jackson Exposed, on which veteran producer Steve Levine, who's done everybody from the Beach Boys to Motorhead and is a massive soul head, goes back to the tapes and remixes them for the modern ear. Not remixing in the Steve Aoki, let's put a banging 4/4 and some headachy keyboards on it, but more in the loving manner of restoring a classic car or perhaps a lovely fireplace. Let's have a taster. This is Never Change Lovers in the Middle of the Night. Never Change Lovers in the Middle of the Night by Millie Jackson from Exposed, the new reconstruction or restoration or something or other by producer Steve Levine. I did think there was a slight does your chewing gum lose its flavour on the bedpost overnight vibe to that one. But never mind. Sophie, where do you stand on the eternal virtues of 70s soul? It's the best, isn't it? It's the best stuff.
I mean, that's a big question, isn't it? Because there's all sorts of little subgenres of 70s soul. I mean, I love Millie Jackson. I think her voice is wonderful. I feel like the Millie Jackson songs that I love the best tend to be the slow burners, and I feel like a lot of the time her voice was used on these kind of like rumpy pumpy little disco numbers where the sort of the subtlety and raunch actually of her voice gets a bit wasted. But I loved what he's done with this record, and I think one of the things I really liked was that sometimes he's just really subtly extended the song. Yeah. And I've always loved a song that makes you wait a bit. You know how, like in Tiny Dancer, you've waited like 4 minutes till you get the chorus. Mm. Yeah. And so with this, because the recording and the tune and the arrangements are so good, it's like, yeah, give me a bit more. Fine. That's great.
And he's rearranged that. So I Cry opens the album, and it's almost like this amazing sort of overture where you're waiting for Millie to turn up in a cloud
exactly
of dry ice.
That. Or like, you know, in the 40s where you'd get the entire song and then someone has a little sing right at the end. It's got that too. But also, as you say, with the this idea of restoring a classic car, it's like, you know, with an old soul record, there are going to be concerns about, is it still authentic or has it been made disgusting somehow? And like, with a classic car, if you took the engine out and polished it really nicely, you know, and popped it back in the car would just run a bit better. Mm. You know, and that's inauthentic. And so I think they've made it kind of immaculate in a way which does still work.
Yeah, I mean, because we usually, when you see remix of 70s soul, it's like, oh no, run to the hills. Yeah. You know, Ben Liebrand or somebody's put a jacking 4/4 1988 house beat on it and ruined it.
And made it into bar music.
And made it into crap bar music. And this is not that at all. This is, like, he's gone right back to the tapes. He's found bits on the tapes that were never released. I think he's actually created a duet with Isaac Hayes, which may be ahistorical. So we're back to Beatles anthology land here, aren't we? Is it really authentic or is it a new thing? I don't care. I thought it sounded fantastic. And what did you think?
I'm not... Some of it worked very well for me. I wasn't entirely convinced by all of it. I mean, you're right. It is sort of what we would call an old-fashioned remix in that he hasn't added any new elements to it. He's taken the elements that are there and literally rebalanced them and added, you know, tightened up the drums a bit. And what I didn't like was the times that he's added a delayed reverb on the vocal. And I found that was a bit distracting. And I just wanted to hear Millie Jackson in her glory. You know, it seemed unnecessary.
See, that's interesting because that's, I mean, although I don't know the technical jargon, I sort of made a little scribble note down here. There's a huge dub echo on If Loving You Is Wrong.
Yeah,
that made me think, you know, what if King Tubby had, had met Al Green? That really intrigued and made me excited.
Well, that rather annoyed me, really. And I thought, why are you doing that? You don't need to do that. And it's quite interesting, actually, because a lot of those soul records are obviously played live. The band is there live. And almost, I thought, because he'd cleaned it all up, one became a bit more aware that the tempos sort of waver a bit, which isn't to the modern taste at all, because we're all sort of used to things being completely played to a click or programmed. And so the fact that it sort of got a bit faster in the chorus and then slowed down a bit, because it had been cleaned up, I became a bit more aware of that.
Do you think that's that sort of extreme on the beat, quantized, fixed thing? Do you think that's to the taste of the modern listener, or is it is it the fashion of the modern studio? Because everybody loved Amy Winehouse because she partly because she wandered all around the beat.
Yeah, exactly. It's easy. It's much easier to do things completely rigidly to a beat, and if somebody plays something out of time, you can see it on your Pro Tools and you put it in time. That's easy. To actually play something beautifully as a band and, you know, sort of do what Amy Winehouse did is quite difficult. And so, yeah, I think you're right. It's not a particular taste thing. It's what we get lumbered with.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm just saying that because he'd sort of made the quality of the recordings more modern, you were a little bit disturbed that the tempos didn't sort of adhere to that.
Because a lot of, you know, if you're not sort of thinking consciously about the sound, you'll forget the things on an old soul or an old reggae or an old rock record that are sort of supposedly flaws. You know, it's maybe there's a few bum notes, or maybe it's like overcompressed, or maybe it's just really tinny. They're actually a feature. They're what you love about them. It's the sound. It's the sound feel. It's the kind of, it creates a whole set of associations that you would not that make them take you into that world.
Well, yes. I mean, when you're making a record, you have to sort of embrace the mistakes sometimes. I mean, if you listen to "Wake Me Up Before You Go Go," listen to the bass part. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Really?
It's all over the place.
Really?
And this is so unusual because, as we've discussed, George Michael was, you know, extremely focused and very rigid in what he wanted. But he used to, he had this great bass player called Dion Estes. And he's just sort of given the whole thing this incredible feel. And it's not entirely in time, and there's a few notes missed out, but it's brilliant. And George was brilliant enough to know, I'm not going to change that. That really gives the thing atmosphere.
Yeah, and lots of new wave records as well. The bass is totally out of tune and often goes out of tune while they're playing. And you get used to that. The ear gets used to it, and there's something quite warm about that. But as we're saying, when everything is quantized in time and in tune, I think that sounds less real, man, doesn't it?
It does. There's loads of strings on this, though. You must be in string heaven on this, right?
Fantastic. Absolutely, completely up my street. And all the string arrangements are gorgeous. And I love the way that he has brought them to the fore. And because he's changed some of the structures, you can hear them. And the brass is beautiful. And it's humbling, really. Yeah. You think, God, they're so good.
And it's really, I think it's incredibly sexy music. Not just because of her personality, but the whole feel of the whole thing. Really sensual, really sexy. There's a track, Go Out and Get Some, which is about going out and getting some. And it's like powerful stuff, you know. Sean, what did you make of this record?
Well, I have to profess some ignorance in that I don't know Millie Jackson that well, so I couldn't compare old recordings to something cleaned up. And I thought, we'll just go with the cleaned up version. I liked it.
I liked it.
Okay.
I love her voice. I love that voice because the voice speaks of experience and depth. She has, you know, she's got the pipes, but you know that she has lived some of the stuff that she's talking about, and it's not squeaky clean. This is someone who has lived some difficult relationships, man, and all that sort of thing. That's what I really liked about it. But I think you have to be in a certain place to listen to it. I was on the overground. It wasn't me with lots of people, and she's singing sexy, raunchy music in my ears, and it wasn't maybe the place to listen. I could
maybe
be
not.
Wrong.
So
I want to actually go back and listen to a mono version almost and hear all the squeaks and the flaws and everything like that in a different situation. I think it would work very well.
Mm, well, it did. Mm. And 70s Soul became a treasure trove of sampling pretty much right at the moment when the Art of Noise was stopping. Because you were sampling everything else, and then suddenly Eric B. and Rakim De La Soul turn up and start mining all this 70s soul. Is it something that you had dabbled with and then kind of not put out, or did you not feel it was part of your sound world?
No, we weren't interested in that. No, we wanted to go back further or go to the future. So we would sort of go back to the 40s and 50s. Yeah. It's funny, we looked at 70s soul. Perhaps it was, we were doing it in the 80s, it didn't seem so long ago.
Yeah. You must be literally the only people making records then who didn't have Funky Drummer on something.
Yeah,
Funky Drummer was on everything.
No, we never had Funky Drummer, no.
Yeah. Good God, setting yourself apart there. I've got to admit, I absolutely love this record. This is my summer album, and I long for today's hip-hop and soul people to assemble a nine-piece band and just let them play, because they're kind of... You know, much as I love my sampled music, hip hop gets more and more clinical and more you can feel the machines, and I just sort of long for that. We did the Fantastic Negrito album last week, which is loads of real musicians doing real music, and it just, you know.
Well, because you're building a vibe, aren't you? Yeah. You know, put a bunch of musicians in a room and you feel the energy. And it's why people like live music as well, isn't it? Because you're making something.
Absolutely. Well, that's my summer tune. What about everybody else's? We are now officially post-solstice, so it's officially summer, which means deciding on the tunes and reading matter for your holidays. Whether you're climbing Machu Picchu or enduring centre parks with the in-laws, proper summer music is essential, and our guests have suggestions for you. First up, let's have a taste of Sophie Harris's suggestions.
Same window, yellow candy screen, six fingers up high, with velvet roses digging freedom fly. A present from you.
Strawberry Letter 23 by Shuggie Otis, followed by Pavement with Summer Babe, and finally Lump with May I Be the Light, all chosen by Sophie Harris. We asked our guest for a classic summer album that you can plug into your ears to keep the seagulls at bay, a new summer album, and your classic summer tune, and a book recommendation, which we can do later. Sophie, your classic tune is Strawberry Letter 23 by Shuggie Otis. This is the original, like the Brothers Johnson one that lots of people know. Tell us about it. Why'd you love it?
Well, but apparently this is the less famous one. I always, because Shuggie was the first one I heard, I assumed that this was the famous one. And because I consider it to be an absolute, like, 10 out of 10, 100% perfect song, I felt like, what? this isn't the famous one? Really? Anyway, it's glorious. It's 1971. I feel like Shuggy was super young when this was made. And, you know, he if you look at pictures of him from back in the day, he's got this really sort of tragic little moustache.
Yes, an Ovaltine
going
moustache,
on.
Isn't it?
And it's because he was so young when he first started playing in clubs with his dad. I think he was maybe 14. And it was, when you think about the stuff that you did when you were like 14 to get into a pub, you know, like we used to... Sorry, my mum's probably listening, but we used to like smoke a cigarette as we were walking through the door of the pub because we thought that would make us look a lot older. Well, and it's like the Shuggy Otis tragic moustache. But he was like, it's like George Michael, so young to have this much kind of musical awareness. And it's such a complex song as well, Strawberry Letter 23. It shifts and it moves about all over the place. But because it's such a essentially good song, you're not aware of what it's doing and the curveballs that it's throwing you. And the arrangement is perfect. The drums are really like soft and subtle. You don't quite know what he's going on about, and it doesn't matter because the feeling of the song is so sort of consistent, and it kind of carries you in that way. And then you have the wig out guitar thing at the end.
And that intro, that sort of keyboardy, I'm not entirely sure what keyboard it is, but it's like that's been sampled to bits, hasn't it? That's been all over the place.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I always wonder with songs that have a particularly strong exposed melody at the beginning, I always think if I was a musician playing live on stage, I would find that incredibly stressful. Have you ever given a performance where there's like these iconic 10 notes that start the song and you're like, oh God, I don't want to mess this up and fingers slipping?
Well, one of the quite difficult piano intros that you sometimes get thrown at if you're playing in a covers band is the intro to Bridge Over Troubled Water. Which you don't want to get wrong.
No.
And it's in quite a difficult key, especially if the singer suddenly says, actually, I'm going to do it in E tonight. And, oh God. Yeah. and you have to play every note exactly as on the record, or everybody knows.
Yeah. Have you ever messed up?
Am I allowed to touch the table? Just
a little bit, yes. Not hard.
Not yet.
Sophie, your classic summer album is Pavement, Slanted and Enchanted. That is the least summery record I can possibly think of.
See, I think it's the essence of summer. Here's my summer music qualifier. I think summer music on holiday, on a beach, horizontal. And this slacker. It's like the archetypal slacker record. Also, it's so the sound of California. You know, it's so laid back and kind of golden and warm. It doesn't sound summery to you?
Not really, but then I suppose when this record came out, I was trapped inside the office of Select magazine trying to get a magazine out and never saw a ray of sunshine at all. Do you think it might be associations in your mind?
Well, possibly. And I was thinking about when I bought this record.
Is it your Interrailing soundtrack?
No, I bought it on vinyl, and it was one of the first vinyl records that I ever bought from HMV. And I bought like four records, and I'd never heard any of them. Got them purely on the recommendation of Writers and the Melody Maker, who I trusted. Like, I trusted them. And I still find it extraordinary to this day that I bought Slanted and Enchanted thinking, I think I'm going to like this. And now it's like one of my just key, most essential, most beloved records, and I'd never heard it when I bought it, and I feel kind of nostalgic, I guess, about that as well.
Blimey. Mm. And your new summer album is Lump by Lump. Now, tell us who Lump are.
Yeah, it's Mike Lindsay from Tongue and Laura Marling, both of whom kind of have this rep for doing new and exciting things with the idea of folk music. And he had been, so the story goes, working on this kind of song cycle. Basically, I think it's all structured around the same note, so he's referred to it as being like a drone, but it just means that the album plays in a really lovely, cohesive way. He had this song cycle, but no singing over the top of it. I believe he bumped into Laura Marling at a bowling alley.
Okay.
They got chatting. Hey, I'd like to sing some lyrics on your record. I'd like to make
strike
up the vocal melodies. Total strike, 80s graphics.
Yes.
So they made this record together. And actually, of all of her recent work, I love what she's done here. And I think just sometimes it's great, whatever artistic discipline you're working in, to just come a bit out of your usual creative kind of comfort zone and even working methods. And again, it has a real kind of California feel to my ears, you know, that lovely kind of golden light And it's super mellifluous and just two really brilliant artists working
together. I think you're avoiding proper beach ambient by Germans on compact records. Just because it got Laura Marling on it, that makes it okay. You should be listening to people with harsh German names just playing a chord for an hour. It's a really
lovely
record.
That could be nice, actually.
Yeah. It's a really lovely record. I was very much enjoying it. But let's face it, it's a terrible name for a band.
Oh, it's awful.
They should be
I can't stand even writing it.
It's terrible. Lump. It sounds like a bad, bad indie band. And actually, it's a lovely bit of sort of washy ambient thing. I think they should be called something like Sandy Cove 3000 or Airport Convention. I think that's what they should be called.
Agree.
Vibiness. Now, you've got two beach books, one trash and one smart. What's your trash book?
So here's the thing. My trash book is The Dirt by Motley Crue. And I remember going on holiday with my best friend in my, I guess, early 20s. And I think I was reading something very serious, a sort of like Richard Brautigan, poignant, profound, and really enjoying it. But my best mate was reading The Dirt by Motley Crue. And I remember she'd be like periodically laughing out loud, ha, 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 then having a little cry. And I remember just looking over at her at one point thinking, she's having more fun than me. And I was thinking, but I don't know about Motley Crue. I don't care about them. I think they're probably quite stupid. But I want to read this book, and started reading it. And sure enough, you know, I laughed, I cried. So it's super readable. The only thing that I'd say is that having kind of gone back to it a bit after saying to you, oh, yeah, this is a really fun beach book, you know, post Me Too, it is a bit disturbing.
Yeah, they're horrible.
Honestly.
Pre Me Too, it was quite disturbing as well.
Yeah, I think probably because of, you know, being in my early 20s, my sort of rock and roll years, I thought, yeah, okay, fine. And I was like, oh, no, it's really not fine. I mean, everyone gets their comeuppance in the end, most definitely, and not least because grunge happens when they're trying to make their big comeback and no one's remotely interested.
So cosmic justice pays out in the end.
Cosmic justice is served. But yes, I'd take it with a pinch of salt. It might be one you'd kind of download, read a bit of, and then push away.
So it's the rock and roll version of a big fat Jackie Collins.
There's
no merit whatsoever.
Or fried chicken that's not even Kentucky Fried Chicken. Yeah. You know, like
Memphis Fried Chicken or Warrington Fried Chicken. That kind of
Southeast
thing.
London. Yeah.
What's your smart book?
So my smart book is Imagine Me Gone by Adam Hazlett, and it's, you know, honestly, probably one of my favourite books of all time. It came out a couple of years ago, and I'm not sure exactly how I found it, although subsequently found out that Pitchfork had picked up on it and interviewed the author. So here's the thing. You could say, oh, it's a family saga, and I find that idea applied to books a bit like, oh, God, this is going to be some, like, 1,000-page trudge through some kind of misery memoir. It's not that at all. It deals with mental health, basically, and the mental health issues of a dad in America and the son told through the eyes of the brother. And it's based on the author's own experience. It's incredibly moving, and there's the lightness of his touch when he writes is really quite extraordinary. It's really sad in parts, but it's also really, really funny. So there's a whole section at the beginning where Michael, the brother who is who suffers terribly with depression as a teen, is on a cruise, and he's writing these letters home, which you gradually realise are turning into complete fantasy. But he's writing about Donna Summer and disco and how it's rocking his world. And it's basically, it's like the best music criticism you've ever read, and so funny. Like, I've roared with laughter reading this book. And so if you're like a bit of a sensitive music lover, like, I cannot imagine a better, more satisfying,
that's our listeners,
moving
pale
book.
And interesting. Pale flowers. They're all pale flowers.
And then at the end, it's one of those ones, you know, when you read a great summer book and probably it makes you cry at the end, and so you're like sniffling away in your garden and it's really warm and your heart's feeling all sorts of things and it all feels a bit kind of strange and wonderful.
Well, there we go. So Sophie's choices are going to ruin your holiday, Mike, by giving you depression on the beach.
Sorry, you guys.
We're going to have a listen to some of Anne's choices now and talk about that.
Beach baby, give me your hand, give me something that I can sand from July to the end of September. Surfing was fun, we'd be out in the sun every day.
Hop on the bus, Gus, you don't need to discuss much. Just just drop off the key and get yourself free. Ooh, slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. You don't need to be coy, Roy. You just listen to me. Hop on the bus, Gus. You don't need to discuss much. Just drop off the key and get yourself free.
Dudley's Summer Stuff. That was First Class, or The First Class, with Beach Baby, followed by Paul Simon with 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. And finally, ABBA's Gimme Gimme Gimme, redone in astonishing style by Nils Landgren from an album called, believe it or not, Funky ABBA. Anne, let's start with Beach Baby by The First Class, your classic summer tune. There's a hell of a lot of Beach Boys going on there, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, First Class didn't... it's from another era, right? It's from the 70s, which mm-hmm. we've been talking a bit about the 70s. And First Class didn't really even exist as a band. They were like a session group because it's the whole pop scene was completely different then. It was sort of dominated by songwriters. And, a pair of songwriters would get together a group of great singers and they'd have a song that they thought was a hit and they'd give the singers a name. And... they'd get a band together and they'd get some great arrangements going. And then, you know, that's how Beach Baby came about. It's sung by the legendary Tony Burrows, who sang on everything in the 70s. I think he was on Top of the Pops about... once he was on three times with three different bands.
In the same episode?
Yeah, because that's what it was like.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this track is just so unashamedly happy. Mm. And happy music, and especially music that's a bit witty and a bit funny, is really quite rare.
It's hard to do, I'm told, by musicians. Genuine happiness.
Genuine happiness.
Easy to do sadness. Dead
oh,
easy.
Yeah, dead yeah. easy. A few minor chords, you know, you're there.
Yeah.
Bish bosh. But Beach Baby, Beach Bobby, there on the sand from July to the end of September. I mean, you can't argue with that, can you?
You can't. It's like Chinny Chap doing the Beach Boys.
Yeah.
And apparently it was made in East Sheen.
Yeah.
The least California-ish place on
Hancock
the planet.
Hancock Land.
Absolutely.
Probably recorded...
That was Cheam.
Yeah, Cheam, 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 yeah.
Probably recorded it and mixed in a day or something.
But it's like, it's such a huge wedding cake of ridiculousness, isn't it? There's a lot going on.
Yeah, there's brilliant string arrangement. I don't know who did the string and brass arrangements, but they're just, it's the sort of thing that I listened to and I as a kid and I thought, God, I really love that. I don't know how that's done. I really want to do that.
They need to stick it out again with a sticker on the front that says Dudley approved. Approved by Dudley. And Paul Simon's Ultimate Collection is your ultimate summer album.
Yeah.
Best of the Beatles. Choose the best ones. What is it that you love particularly about that collection?
Paul Simon. I love everything about Paul Simon. I mean, Paul Simon is actually on his farewell tour at the moment called Homeward Bound. Mm. And when you think about it, he's been a sort of iconic songwriter for 40 years, 50 years from the sort of folk-influenced Simon Garfunkel stuff. And then he did the sort of jazzy stuff like 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. He did Graceland, which is an absolute classic. And his music is just endlessly fascinating, intelligent lyrically, and beautiful tunes.
Yeah. What always surprised me about that kind of slice of his career, the 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover, that time, is it always sounds like it was recorded yesterday. It always sounds brilliantly contemporary.
Yeah.
Some of the other stuff, I mean, Graceland is great, but it's sort of, you can tell where it came from. It's dated a bit.
Mm-hmm.
50 Ways just sounds out of time. The way Kraftwerk sound out of time. They don't seem to exist at a particular moment in time. They're just eternal.
Yeah. I mean, this is from a compilation which was released not long ago called The Ultimate Collection, I think. So there's you know, quite a variety of stuff from various stages of his career on it. And I just think if you wanted something to listen to on the beach, which would take you back and be, it's just great.
Yeah. And what's going on with this ABBA record then? This is a very strange one. Funky ABBA. A lot of people would say you can't rearrange ABBA. You're not allowed to rearrange ABBA.
No, exactly. That's exactly what I thought. This guy, Nils Landgren, nobody's heard of him here. He's a Swedish musician. He's a trombonist. He's a fantastic jazz trombonist, right? But he also has this wonderful vocal style, and he does these very strange covers of things. You want to listen to his cover of I Will Survive. He'll change the chords. It's just... And, of course, being Swedish, I mean, ABBA is royalty for them. It's like bigger than Volvo. So, and then and he sort of... He takes these ABBA tunes and he gives them a genuinely original new slant. And it's funny and entertaining and... I mean, don't we all love ABBA?
Yes, it's certainly the kind. I could picture myself in a very odd beach bar and this come on, and I would go, "What?" Because it has. It is definitely summer breeze like jazz. Not everyone's cup of tea, but certainly that's kind of it's bold, isn't it, to have a go at ABBA like that.
Yeah, and I think he gets away with it because he is a brilliant musician.
So this is the Nils Frandgren Funk Unit with Funky ABBA, if you want to find that on Spotify and be amazed. And your summer book is William Boyd's Ordinary Thunderstorms, which is quite a brutal thriller by the sound of things. Tell us a bit about it.
Yes, I mean, it depends what you want to read on the beach, really. I mean, last year I read Sapiens on the beach because, you know, I'd take one chapter and sort of read it and then sort of spend the rest of the day thinking about it. But that's not always what you want. Sometimes you just want a very exciting story that takes you from A to B via Z, hopefully. And William Boyd is just a great writer. And I recently reread this and I thought, oh, it's such a great London story. And so if you're sort of away somewhere sunny and beautiful, and you know, you can remind yourself of the darker side of London. And the Thames is so central to this story. I don't want to give anything away because it actually is genuinely unputdownable.
Right. So we like on beaches to sit there reading about people having horrible times back home and reminding ourselves that we're not there.
Well, I do, yes. That's my idea of a funky time, yes.
So that's William Boyd and Ordinary Thunderstorms. And I think that's the end of the show. Thanks to our special guests, Sophie Harris, for coming in.
Oh, such
so you've
a
got
pleasure.
To go, you're moving house. So you've got to, you'll now be going through piles of records, going, "Do I really need this? Do I really need this?"
I mean, records, they're all in now. Like that's it. There's no more chucking out. Like the vinyl, the CDs. I'm finally getting rid of. It's done.
You don't want to do that.
Why?
You don't want to do that.
No,
because
don't.
CD's the next vinyl in 5 years' time. Yeah.
But the horrid clacky jewel cases.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, that was the trouble. The cheap jewel cases didn't do them any favours. But CD is a great format.
I agree.
I'm sorry. Because vinyl is much more difficult. Well, you know. Don't get me started.
Yeah.
I don't even have a CD player anymore.
Oh. Get one.
Get one.
You can play them on DVD players.
Oh, it's incredibly...
I had just finally come to the point in my heart where I thought, let them go, Soph. They're obsolete.
No, they're not obsolete. No. It's the next vinyl, I'm telling you.
But if you say so, then I have to keep them.
Oh, God. So we've ruined your day now, haven't
Basically.
We? Sorry about that. Well, do come on the show again and we'll ruin your day again on something else. Anne Dudley, your new album, Anne Dudley Plays the Art of Noise, is out now. Will there be an Anne Dudley Plays ABC Propaganda in the Pet Shop Boys? She's thinking about it.
I'll get back to you on that.
Okay. Thank you for coming in. And thanks to everybody. And thanks to Sean Pattenden and our producer, Jack Clarament. Don't forget, you can hear all of our past episodes at audioboom.com/bigmouth. And if you want to support the show, you can buy us that virtual pint via patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast. We'll see you next week. And now, with a bit of luck, Anne might play us out on the untuned bad studio piano.
Yeah, well, I may not be able to make this sound any good.
But we're going to give it a try.
It was tuned in 1974.
Brilliant.